Well, you immediately invest all of your money in the stock market, equally divided between the shares of these two companies. As you can easily check by working out a few examples, no matter what happens on the next day, your investment cannot lose value. At worst, it can remain the same if both companies again close at $1. But any movement of share prices consistent with your insider information will increase your holdings. For instance, if the fitness company closes at $4 and the heart valve company closes at $0.25, 25 cents, their combined value is $4.25 for each pair of shares, compared with $2 the previous day. Furthermore, from the perspective of net worth, it does not matter one bit whether the fitness company closes high and the heart valve company low or vice versa. If you care only about the total amount of money, these two distinct circumstances are financially indistinguishable. The situation in string theory is analogous in that the energy in string configurations comes from two sources, vibrations and windings, whose contributions to the total energy of a string are generally different. But, as we shall see in more detail below, certain pairs of distinct geometrical circumstances, leading to high winding energy, low vibration energy, or low winding energy, high vibration energy, are physically indistinguishable. And, unlike the financial analogy for which considerations beyond total wealth can distinguish between the two types of stock holdings, there is absolutely no physical distinction between the two string scenarios. Actually, we shall see that to make the analogy with string theory tighter, we should consider what would happen if you did not divide your money equally between the two companies in your initial investment, but bought, say, 1,000 shares of the fitness company and 3,000 shares of the heart valve company. Now the total value of your holdings does depend on which company closes high and which closes low. For instance, if the stocks close at $10, fitness, and 10 cents, heart valve, your initial investment of $4,000 will now be worth $10,300. If the reverse happens, the stocks close at 10 cents, fitness, and $10, heart valve, your holdings will be worth $30,100, significantly more. Nevertheless, the inverse relationship between the stock closing prices does ensure the following. If a friend of yours invests exactly opposite to you, 3,000 shares of the fitness company and 1,000 shares of the heart valve company, then the value of her holdings will be $10,300 if stocks close valves high, fitness low, the same as your holdings in the fitness high, valves low closing, and $30,100 if they close with fitness high, valves low, again the same as your holdings in the reciprocal situation. That is, from the point of view of total stock value, interchanging which stock closes high and which closes low is exactly compensated by interchanging the number of shares you own of each company. Hold this last observation in mind as we now return to string theory and think about the possible string energies in a specific example. Imagine that the radius of the circular garden hose dimension is, say, 10 times the Planck length. We will write this as R equals 10. A string can wrap around this circular dimension one time, two times, three times, and so forth. The number of times a string wraps around the circular dimension is called its winding number. The energy from winding, being determined by the length of wound string, is proportional to the product of the radius and the winding number. Additionally, for any amount of winding, the string can undergo vibrational motion. As the uniform vibrations we are currently focusing on have energies that are inversely dependent on the radius, they are proportional to whole number multiples of the reciprocal of the radius, 1 over r, which in this case is 1/10 of the Planck length. We call this whole number multiple the vibration number. As you can see, this situation is very similar to what we encountered on Wall Street, with the winding and vibration numbers being direct analogs of the shares held in the two companies, while R and 1 over R are the analogs of the closing prices per share in each. Now, just as you can easily calculate the total value of your investment from the number of shares held in each company and the closing prices, we can calculate the total energy carried by a string in terms of its vibration number, its winding number, and the radius. Winding energies come in multiples of 10, while vibrational energies come in multiples of the smaller number 1/10. Now imagine that the radius of the circular dimension shrinks, say, from 10 to 9.2 to 7.1, and on down to 3.4, 2.2, 1.1, 0.7, all the way down to 0.1, 1/10, where, for our present discussion, it stops. Winding energies are now multiples of 1/10, while vibration energies are multiples of its reciprocal 10. Vibration and winding contributions play complementary roles when the radius of the circular dimension changes from 10 to 1/10. And so, as far as total string energies go, there is no distinction between these different sizes for the circular dimension. Just as the interchange of fitness high, valves low with valves high, fitness low is exactly compensated by the interchange of the number of shares held in each company, interchange of radius 10 and radius 1/10 is exactly compensated by the interchange of vibration and winding numbers. Moreover, while for simplicity we have focused on an initial radius of R equals 10 and its reciprocal 1/10, the conclusions drawn are the same for any choice of the radius and its reciprocal. We therefore conclude that the masses and the charges of particles in a garden hose universe with radius R are completely identical to those in a garden hose universe with radius 1 over R. And since these masses and force charges govern fundamental physics, there is no way to distinguish physically these two geometrically distinct universes. Any experiment done in one such universe has a corresponding experiment that can be done in the other, leading to exactly the same results. A debate. George and Gracie, after being flattened out into two-dimensional beings, take up residence as physics professors in the garden hose universe. After setting up their competing laboratories, each claims to have determined the size of the circular dimension. Surprisingly, although each has a reputation for carrying out research with great precision, their conclusions do not agree. George claims that the circular radius is R equals 10 times the Planck length, while Gracie claims that the circular radius is R equals 1/10 times the Planck length. In a flash of insight, Gracie shows George that their two calculations are actually identical. Now George, who, as is well known, reasons a bit more slowly than Gracie, replies, "How can this be? I know that different values for the radius give rise, through basic quantum mechanics and the properties of wound strings, to different possible values for string energies and string charges. If we agree on the latter, then we must agree on the radius." Gracie, using her newfound insight into string physics, replies, "What you say is almost, but not quite, correct. It is usually true that two different values for the radius give rise to different allowed energies. However, in the special circumstance when the two values for the radius are inversely related to one another, like 10 and 1/10, then the allowed energies and charges are actually identical. You see, what you would call a winding mode, I would call a vibration mode. And what you would call a vibration mode, I would call a winding mode. But nature does not care about the language we use. Instead, physics is governed by the properties of the fundamental ingredients, the particle masses, energies, and the force charges they carry. And whether the radius is R or 1 over R, the complete list of these properties for the fundamental ingredients in string theory is identical." In a moment of bold comprehension, George responds, "I think I understand. Although the detailed description you and I might give for strings may differ, whether they are wound around the circular dimension or the particulars of their vibrational behavior, the complete list of physical characteristics they can attain is the same. Therefore, since the physical properties of the universe depend upon these properties of the basic constituents, there is no distinction, no way to differentiate between radii that are inversely related to one another. Exactly. Three questions. At this point, you might say, look, if I was a little being in the garden hose universe, I would simply measure the circumference of the hose with a tape measure, and thereby unambiguously determine the radius. No ifs, ands, or buts. So what is this nonsense about two indistinguishable possibilities with different radii? Furthermore, doesn't string theory do away with sub-Planck distances? So why are we even talking about circular dimensions with radii that are a fraction of the Planck length? And finally, while we're at it, who really cares about the two-dimensional garden hose universe? What does all this add up to when we include all dimensions? Let's begin with the last question, as the answer will force us to come face-to-face with the first two. Although our discussion has taken place in the garden hose universe, we restricted ourselves to one extended and one curled-up spatial dimension merely for simplicity. If we have three extended spatial dimensions and six circular dimensions, the latter being the simplest of all Calabi-Yau spaces, the conclusion is exactly the same. Each of the circles has a radius that, if interchanged with its reciprocal, yields a physically identical universe. We can even take this conclusion one giant step further. In our universe, we observe three spatial dimensions, each of which, according to astronomical observations, appears to extend for about 15 billion light years. A light year is about 6 trillion miles, so this distance is about 90 billion trillion miles. As mentioned in Chapter 8, nothing tells us what happens after that. We do not know whether they continue on indefinitely or perhaps curve back on themselves in the shape of an enormous circle beyond the visual sensitivity of state-of-the-art telescopes. If the latter is the case, an astronaut traveling out into space, continuously going in a fixed direction, would ultimately circle around the universe, like Magellan traveling around the Earth, and wind up back at the initial starting point. The familiar extended dimensions, therefore, may very well also be in the shape of circles and hence subject to the R and 1 over R physical identification of string theory. To put some rough numbers in, if the familiar dimensions are circular, then their radii must be about as large as the 15 billion light years mentioned above, which is about 10 trillion 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 trillion, R equals 10 to the 61st power, times the Planck length, and growing as the universe expands. If string theory is right, this is physically identical to the familiar dimensions being circular with incredibly tiny radii of about 1 over R equals 1 over 10 to the 61st power equals 10 to the minus 61st power times the Planck length. These are our well-known familiar dimensions in an alternate description provided by string theory. In fact, in this reciprocal language, these tiny circles are getting ever smaller as time goes by, since as R grows, 1 over R shrinks. Now we seem to have really gone off the deep end. How can this possibly be true? How can a 6-foot-tall human being fit inside such an unbelievably microscopic universe? How can such a speck of a universe be physically identical to the great expanse we view in the heavens? Furthermore, we are now led forcefully to the second of our initial three questions. String theory was supposed to eliminate the ability to probe sub-Planck distances. But if a circular dimension has radius r, whose length is larger than the Planck length, its reciprocal 1 over r is necessarily a fraction of the Planck length. So what is going on? The answer, which will also address the first of our three questions, highlights an important and subtle aspect of space and distance. Two interrelated notions of distance in string theory. Distance is such a basic concept in our understanding of the world that it is easy to underestimate the depth of its subtlety. With the surprising effects that special and general relativity have had on our notions of space and time, and the new features arising from string theory, we are led to be a bit more careful, even in our definition of distance. The most meaningful definitions in physics are those that are operational, that is, definitions that provide a means, at least in principle, for measuring whatever is being defined. After all, no matter how abstract a concept is, having an operational definition allows us to boil down its meaning to an experimental procedure for measuring its value. How can we give an operational definition of the concept of distance? The answer to this question in the context of string theory is rather surprising. In 1988, the physicists Robert Brandenburger of Brown University and Kumrun Vafa of Harvard University pointed out that if the spatial shape of a dimension is circular, there are two different yet related operational definitions of distance in string theory. Each lays out a distinct experimental procedure for measuring distance and is based, roughly speaking, on the simple principle that if a probe travels at a fixed and known speed, then we can measure a given distance by determining how long the probe takes to traverse it. The difference between the two procedures is the choice of probe used. The first definition uses strings that are not wound around a circular dimension, whereas the second definition uses strings that are wound. We see that the extended nature of the fundamental probe is responsible for there being two natural operational definitions of distance in string theory. In a point particle theory, for which there is no notion of winding, there would be only one such definition. How do the results of each procedure differ? The answer found by Brandenburger and Vafa is as surprising as it is subtle. The rough idea underlying the result can be understood by appealing to the uncertainty principle. Unwound strings can move around freely and probe the full circumference of the circle, a length proportional to R. By the uncertainty principle, their energies are proportional to 1 over R. Recall from Chapter 6 the inverse relation between the energy of a probe and the distances to which it is sensitive. On the other hand, we have seen that wound strings have minimum energy proportional to R. As probes of distances, the uncertainty principle tells us that they are therefore sensitive to the reciprocal of this value, 1 over R. The mathematical embodiment of this idea shows that if each is used to measure the radius of a circular dimension of space, unwound string probes will measure R, while wound strings will measure 1 over R, where, as before, we are measuring distances in multiples of the Planck length. The result of each experiment has an equal claim to being the radius of the circle. What we learn from string theory is that using different probes to measure distance can result in different answers. In fact, this property extends to all measurements of lengths and distances, not just to determining the size of a circular dimension. The results obtained by wound and unwound string probes will be inversely related to one another. If string theory describes our universe, why have we not encountered these two possible notions of distance in any of our day-to-day or scientific endeavors? Anytime we talk about distance, we do so in a manner that conforms to our experience of there being one concept of distance without any hint of there being a second notion. Why have we missed the alternative possibility? The answer is that although there is a high degree of symmetry in our discussion, whenever R, and hence 1 over R as well, differs significantly from the value 1, meaning again 1 times the Planck length, then one of our operational definitions proves extremely difficult to carry out, while the other proves extremely easy to carry out. In essence, we have always carried out the easy approach, completely unaware of there being another possibility. The discrepancy in difficulty between the two approaches is due to the very different masses of the probes used. High winding energy, low vibration energy, and vice versa, if the radius R, and hence 1 over R as well, differs significantly from the Planck length, that is, R equals 1. High energy here, for radii that are vastly different from the Planck length, corresponds to incredibly massive probes, billions and billions of times heavier than the proton, for instance, while low energy corresponds to probe masses at most a speck above zero. In such circumstances, there is a monumental difference in difficulty between the two approaches, since even producing the heavy string configurations is an undertaking that, at present, is beyond our technological prowess. In practice, then, only one of the two approaches is technologically feasible, the one involving the lighter of the two types of string configurations. This is the one used implicitly in all of our discussions involving distance encountered to this point. This is the one that informs and hence meshes with our intuition. Putting issues of practicality aside, in a universe governed by string theory, one is free to measure distances using either of the two approaches. When astronomers measure the size of the universe, they do so by examining photons that have traveled across the cosmos and have happened to enter their telescopes. No pun intended, photons are the light string modes in this situation. The result obtained is the 10 to the 61st power times the Planck length quoted earlier. If the three familiar spatial dimensions are in fact circular, and string theory is right, astronomers using vastly different, and currently non-existent, equipment, in principle, should be able to measure the extent of the heavens with heavy wound string modes and find a result that is the reciprocal of this huge distance. It is in this sense that we can think of the universe as being either huge, as we normally do, or terribly minute. According to the light string modes, the universe is large and expanding. According to the heavy modes, it is tiny and contracting. There is no contradiction here. Instead, we have two distinct but equally sensible definitions of distance. We are far more familiar with the first definition due to technological limitations, but, nevertheless, each is an equally valid concept. Now we can answer our earlier question about big humans in a little universe. When we measure the height of a human and find 6 feet, for instance, we necessarily use the light string modes. To compare their size to that of the universe, we must use the same measuring procedure, and, as above, this yields 15 billion light years for the size of the universe, a result that is much larger than 6 feet. Asking how such a person can fit into the tiny universe, as measured by the heavy string modes, is asking a meaningless question. It's comparing apples and oranges. Since we now have two concepts of distance, using light or heavy string probes, we must compare measurements made in the same manner. A minimum size. It's been a bit of a trek, but we are now set for the key point. If one does stick to measuring distances the easy way, that is, using the lightest of the string modes instead of the heavy ones, the results obtained will always be larger than the Planck length. To see this, let's think through the hypothetical big crunch for the three extended dimensions, assuming them to be circular. For argument's sake, let's say that at the beginning of our thought experiment, unwound string modes are the light ones, and by using them, it is determined that the universe has an enormously large radius and that it is shrinking in time. As it shrinks, these unwound modes get heavier and the winding modes get lighter. When the radius shrinks all the way to the Planck length, that is, when R takes on the value 1, the winding and vibration modes have comparable mass. The two approaches to measuring distance become equally difficult to carry out and, moreover, each will yield the same result since one is its own reciprocal. As the radius continues to shrink, the winding modes become lighter than the unwound modes and hence, since we are always opting for the easier approach, they should now be used to measure distances. According to this method of measurement, which yields the reciprocal of that measured by the unwound modes, the radius is larger than 1 times the Planck length and increasing. This simply reflects that as R, the quantity measured by unwound strings, shrinks to 1 and continues to get smaller, 1 over R, the quantity measured by wound strings, grows to 1 and gets larger. Therefore, if one takes care to always use the light string modes, the easy approach to measuring distance, the minimal value encountered is the Planck length. In particular, a Big Crunch to zero size is avoided, as the radius of the universe is measured using light string probes is always larger than the Planck length. Rather than heading through the Planck length onto even smaller size, the radius, as measured by the lightest string modes, decreases to the Planck length and then immediately starts to increase. The crunch is replaced by a bounce. Using light string modes to measure distances aligns with our conventional notion of length, the one that was around long before the discovery of string theory. It is according to this notion of distance, as seen in Chapter 5, that we encountered insurmountable problems with violent quantum undulations if sub-Planck-scale distances play a physical role. We once again see, from this complementary perspective, that the ultra-short distances are avoided by string theory. In the physical framework of general relativity and in the corresponding mathematical framework of Riemannian geometry, there is a single concept of distance, and it can acquire arbitrarily small values. In the physical framework of string theory, and correspondingly in the realm of the emerging discipline of quantum geometry, there are two notions of distance. By judiciously making use of both, we find a concept of distance that meshes with both our intuition and with general relativity when distance scales are large, but that differs from them dramatically when distance scales get small. Specifically, sub-Planck scale distances are inaccessible. As this discussion is quite subtle, let's re-emphasize one central point. If we were to spurn the distinction between easy and hard approaches to measuring length and, say, continue to use the unwound modes as R shrinks through the Planck length, it might seem that we would indeed be able to encounter a sub-Planck length distance. But the paragraphs above inform us that the word distance in the last sentence must be carefully interpreted, since it can have two different meanings, only one of which conforms to our traditional notion. And in this case, when R shrinks to sub-Planck length, but we continue to use the unwound strings, even though they have now become heavier than the wound strings, we are employing the hard approach to measuring distance, and hence the meaning of distance does not conform to our standard usage. However, the discussion is far more than one of semantics or even of convenience or practicality of measurement. Even if we choose to use the non-standard notion of distance and thereby describe the radius as being shorter than the Planck length, the physics we encounter, as discussed in previous sections, will be identical to that of a universe in which the radius in the conventional sense of distance is larger than the Planck length. And it is physics, not language, that really matters. Brandenburger, Waffe, and other physicists have made use of these ideas to suggest a rewriting of the laws of cosmology, in which both the Big Bang and the possible Big Crunch do not involve a zero-size universe, but rather one that is Planck length in all dimensions. This is certainly a very appealing proposal for avoiding the mathematical, physical, and logical conundrums of a universe that emanates from or collapses to an infinitely dense point. Although it is conceptually difficult to imagine the whole of the universe compressed together into a tiny Planck-sized nugget, it is truly beyond the pale to imagine it crushed to a point of no size at all. String cosmology, as we shall discuss in Chapter 14, is a field very much in its infancy, but one that holds great promise and may very well provide us with this easier-to-swallow alternative to the standard Big Bang model. How general is this conclusion? What if the spatial dimensions are not circular in shape? Do these remarkable conclusions about minimum spatial extent in string theory still hold? No one knows for sure. The essential aspect of circular dimensions is that they permit the possibility of wound strings. As long as the spatial dimensions, regardless of the details of their shape, allow strings to wind around them, most of the conclusions we have drawn should still apply. But what if, say, two of the dimensions are in the shape of a sphere? In this case, strings cannot get trapped in a wound configuration, because they can always slip off, much as a stretched rubber band can pop off a basketball. Does string theory nevertheless limit the size to which these dimensions can shrink? Numerous investigations seem to show that the answer depends on whether a full spatial dimension is being shrunk, as in the examples in this chapter, or, as we shall encounter and explain in chapters 11 and 13, an isolated chunk of space is collapsing. The general belief among string theorists is that, regardless of shape, there is a minimum limiting size, much as in the case of circular dimensions, so long as we are shrinking a full spatial dimension. Establishing this expectation is an important goal for further research because it has a direct impact on a number of aspects of string theory, including its implications for cosmology. Mirror symmetry. Through general relativity, Einstein forged a link between the physics of gravity and the geometry of space-time. At first blush, string theory strengthens and broadens the link between physics and geometry, since the properties of vibrating strings, their mass, and the force charges they carry, are largely determined by the properties of the curled-up component of space. We have just seen, though, that quantum geometry, the geometry-physics association in string theory, has some surprising twists. In general relativity and in conventional geometry, a circle of radius r is different from one whose radius is 1 over r, pure and simple. Yet, in string theory, they are physically indistinguishable. This leads us to be bold enough to go further and ask whether there might be geometrical forms of space that differ in more drastic ways, not just in overall size, but possibly also in shape, but that are nevertheless physically indistinguishable in string theory. In 1988, Lance Dixon of the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center made a pivotal observation in this regard that was further amplified by Wolfgang Lerche of CERN, Vafa at Harvard, and Nicholas Warner, then of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Based upon aesthetic arguments rooted in considerations of symmetry, these physicists made the audacious suggestion that it might be possible for two different Calabi-Yau shapes, chosen for the extra curled-up dimensions in string theory, to give rise to identical physics. To give you an idea of how this rather far-fetched possibility might actually occur, recall that the number of holes in the extra Calabi-Yau dimensions determines the number of families into which string excitations will arrange themselves. These holes are analogous to the holes one finds in a torus or in its multi-handled cousins. A six-dimensional Calabi-Yau space can have holes of a variety of dimensions. Although such holes are harder to picture, they can be described with well-understood mathematics. A key fact is that the number of families of particles arising from string vibrations is sensitive only to the total number of holes, not to the number of holes of each particular dimension. That's why, for instance, we did not worry about drawing distinctions between the different types of holes in our discussion in Chapter 9. Imagine, then, two Calabi-Yau spaces in which the number of holes in various dimensions differs, but in which the total number of holes is the same. Since the number of holes in each dimension is not the same, the two Calabi-Yaus have different shapes. But since they have the same total number of holes, each yields a universe with the same number of families. This, of course, is but one physical property. Agreement on all physical properties is a far more restrictive requirement. But this at least gives the flavor of how the Dixon-Lerche-Vafa-Warner conjecture could possibly be true. In the fall of 1987, I joined the physics department at Harvard as a postdoctoral fellow, and my office was just down the hall from Vafa's. As my thesis research had focused on the physical and mathematical properties of curled-up Calabi-Yau dimensions in string theory, Vafa kept me closely apprised of his work in this area. When he stopped by my office in the fall of 1988 and told me of the conjecture that he, Lerche, and Warner had come upon, I was intrigued, but also skeptical. The intrigue arose from the realization that if their conjecture was true, it might open a new avenue of research on string theory. The skepticism arose from the realization that guesses are one thing, established properties of a theory are quite another. During the following months, I thought frequently about their conjecture and, frankly, half convinced myself that it wasn't true. Surprisingly, though, a seemingly unrelated research project I had undertaken in collaboration with Ronan Plesser, then a graduate student at Harvard and now on the faculty of the Wiseman Institute and Duke University, was soon to change my mind completely. Plesser and I had become interested in developing methods for starting with an initial Calabi-Yau shape and mathematically manipulating it to produce hitherto unknown Calabi-Yau shapes.